Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover with you today Ruth, the first chapter, verses 1 through 22. I'm going to call this chapter Naomi is Widowed in Moab, Naomi being Ruth's mother-in-law. Before I begin, let me give you a brief introduction. Ruth is an outsider in several ways. Her culture honored women with children. Ruth had no children. Women were dependent on their husbands. Ruth was a widow. Jewish communities were close-knit. Ruth was a foreigner from Moab, and Ruth was poverty-stricken. So this is a classic rags-to-riches story in the Bible, and of course, it's one of the most popular books in the Old Testament. Movies made about it, Sunday school stories, we all know about Ruth. Now, who wrote this book? It was probably by some unknown writer. As the NIV Study Bible says, well, that really narrows it down. Brilliant comment there, probably by an unknown writer. So we don't know who wrote it. When was the book written? That is unknown too. One estimate put it probably after 1000 BC, the Bible Hub timeline, which I love now to use now. It goes all the way from the beginning to the end of the Bible, Genesis to Revelation, and puts a date. And of course, the dates are approximate a lot of times, but they put it at 1140 BC. So it's during the time of the Judges. In fact, verse 1 says, in the days when the judges governed, so that narrows it down at least to that period. The judges, best way to look at the judges, 1375 B.C., Joshua gives his farewell address, 1050, Saul takes over as king. So in that period, it's the judges. Now, why was the story written? Perhaps it was written to encourage Israelites to include foreigners in their nation. Maybe, but I think the main theme of the book is redemption, redemption, redemption. That's the key theme. The book was written to the people of Israel to teach them about redemption, in my humble opinion. We're going to see Boaz, the famous Boaz, as a kinsman redeemer. He redeemed Ruth out of widowhood and poverty. She was redeemed in this way. She was transformed from poverty to wealth. She was transformed from being a widow to a wife. She was transformed from being a widow to a wife. She was transformed from being barren to fertile, and she was transformed from being a foreigner to an Israelite. So we start now in verse 1. Now it came about in the days when the judges governed, I'll go verse 1 through 3 actually. Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Now in verse 1 it says, when it came about in the days when the judges governed, I've already said that's probably around 1100 or so. Bible Hub timeline has 1140 B.C. At that time there was a famine in the land. Now, this famine was perhaps caused by the depredations of the Philistines and the Ammonites. They carried off grain as soon as it was ripe. They hid it off. Sounds like Gideon's time. It doesn't really say why the famine was there, but it was there and it lasted for a long time, about 10 years, as we'll see in a minute. A certain man of Bethlehem in Judah, that's to distinguish it from another Bethlehem in Zebulun, which is not very famous, mentioned in Joshua 19:15. But this is the famous Bethlehem where Jesus ended up being born. That's where Elimelech and Naomi were from. Both of them went to sojourn in the land of Moab, and the two sons with them, Mahlon and Chilion. The name of the man was Elimelech. In verse 2, Elimelech means, my God is king. Great name. He was a kinsman of Boaz, who will show up in our story in the next chapter. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, Elimelech, kinsman of Elimelech, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now, the text doesn't say, but Gill and Clark speculate that Elimelech died a short time after his arrival in Moab with his wife and two sons. Now, I said the name of Elimelech was, my God is king. The name of his wife was Naomi, which means pleasant. It's a happy family there, except that they were facing famine, hard times. And so they migrated like people who are facing famine all throughout history have done. Remember the grapes of wrath in American history. American literature. People leave. They got to have food. All these barbarian tribes that wandered all through Western medieval history, or early ancient history, actually, constantly looking for more lands and more food. And so this is an old story. Another minor detail here. The family, the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they were Ephrathites of Bethlehem. Ephrathah is just another name for Bethlehem, which shows up several times in Scripture. It might be good to remember that. It means fruitful. For example, in Genesis 35:19, so Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. Now, the two sons of Naomi and Elimelech were named Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon means infirmity. Chilion means finished. Now, that's two great names for your kids. Hey, sickness. Hey, finished. Well, I suspect that Mahlon and Chilion's names were given after they had lived a while in Moab, or maybe after they had lived a while in the famine in Israel, to be named something so pessimistic as that. Why would you name your kids something like that? Little factoid here, Jameson, Vossett, and Brown say that Mahlon and Chilion are supposed to be the same as Joash and Saraph, mentioned in 1 Chronicles 4:22. Who knows? Who cares? Now, the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, when their father Elimelech died, they married Moabite women. Now, there's a conflict of opinion here. Was this a violation of Mosaic law? Well, let's read the scripture that might be relevant, Deuteronomy 7:3. Furthermore, you, God tells, or Moses tells the people, you shall not intermarry with them, with the Canaanites. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. Deuteronomy 23:3. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. Ezra 9:2. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons. This is Ezra speaking to the post-exilic Israelites who had come back into the land and married the pagans around them. Ezra continues, the holy races intermingled with the peoples of the lands. Indeed, the hands of the princes of the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness. Well, so that was a common thing. You don't marry pagans, or at least you don't marry Canaanites. Now, John Gill mentioned some of the Jewish rabbis who say that their early death, Mahlon and Chilion's early death, was because of their violation of God's law. They married Moabite women, and they paid for them. Well, the text doesn't say that, but the rabbis say that. The rabbis go further and say, however, those unlawful acts were permitted so that the Messiah could be born through Ruth. Well, others say, no, they didn't violate the Jewish law. One of my commentators, this is the NIV Study Bible, actually says this, no disapproval by God is implied here. Marriage with the Moabites was not forbidden by God. If you recall, that scripture I read said you're not supposed to marry the Canaanites. The Moabs weren't in Canaan. They were across the Jordan River to the east. Now, Deuteronomy 23:3, says the NIV Study Bible, does say that the Moabites or their sons to the 10th generation were not allowed in the tabernacle. But it doesn't say they're not supposed to marry a Moabite. The NIV Study Bible continues, the Moabites, though not Israelites, were considered distant relatives because they were descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew. As a result, the restrictions against marriage to foreigners did not apply to the Moabites. Well, I will give you my humble opinion on this. I think the Jewish rabbis are right. I don't think it was legal for them to marry a Moabite. I think it's a reasonable extension to go from Canaanite to Moabite. That's a technical distinction, a technical differentiation to save the legality of the act. And I don't really think that that's, it might conform to the letter of the law, but does it conform to the intent of the law? Well, that's a different question. But it doesn't matter whether it was legal or not. God uses illegal acts to bring about his purposes. We go down to Ruth chapter 1, verses 4 through 5. They, that's Mahlon and Chilion, took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman, that's Naomi, was bereft of her two children and her husband. Now, Orpah was the Moabite woman who married Chilion, and Ruth was the Moabite woman who married Mahlon. We know that by reading Ruth chapter 4, verse 10. Boaz is speaking. He says, moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon. That's how we know. The 10 years that Mahlon and Chilion lived in Moab before they died could be 10 years from the time of their marriage to the Moabite women, or it could be from 10 years that they came into the land. It doesn't say. It doesn't matter. Now it says that Naomi is bereft of her two children and her husband, she was in a bad situation. She was deprived of her husband, she was deprived of both of her sons, and she was a foreigner in a strange country. If she had been living in Israel and there was no famine, but there was plenteous harvest, she still would have been in a bad shape because she didn't have her husband, didn't have her sons, because that's how women were supported back then. So she was truly, truly up the creek. We go now to Ruth, chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was, that's Moab, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. So in verse 6, Naomi is getting ready to return to the land of Israel. Why did she not want to stay in Moab? Here are some options. Moab was an idolatrous country. She had better opportunities of serving the Lord in Israel. She might have gotten sick of the paganism, wanted to go back to the land of Yahweh. She had lost her husband there, and so she has no reason to stay in Moab, unless I guess it's to find a Moabite husband, but she didn't want to do that. She had heard that there was more food in Israel, practical reason. Well, in fact, that's what it says. She had heard that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food, his people being the Jews, so she wants to go where food is. I think that's probably her primary motive. I mean, if she's worried about marrying a Moabite husband, I mean, her two sons had married Moabite women, so I'm not so sure she would be averse to that, except perhaps she's a godly woman and doesn't want to do it. But at any rate, whatever her motives were, she's heading back to Israel. She probably heard that that 10-year famine, the famine that was going on for the 10 years that Naomi was in Moab, was over. Otherwise, in my opinion, she would have returned home earlier to get back to her home folks if the famine had been over earlier. So Naomi and the two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, went on the way to return to the land of Judah. They didn't return to Judah. They just went on the road headed toward Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that Ruth or Orpah were returning to Israel. They had never been to Israel. It just means that it was the way to return to Israel. Can't return to a place you've never been to. In verse 8, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house." And what she means there is go back. Go back to Moab. The women had probably reached the borders of Israel. Naomi is just assuming she's being accompanied by the daughters-in-law for companionship and courtesy and so forth. She's reached the border. She says, "Okay, you can't go any further. Go back. Go back to your mother's house." Now, why not say go back to your father's house? Well, here's three options for that. Option number one, they had no father who was then living. But against that, in Ruth 2:11, we read this. Boaz replied to Ruth, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, Moab." So Ruth's father and mother were still living. So why did Naomi say return to your mother's house? Well, John Gill speculates is because mothers are most affectionate to their daughters. They're more affectionate than fathers are, and so that's why she mentioned mothers. John Gill and Adam Clark mentioned this, that women in those times had separate apartments, and they used to take widowed daughters back to live with themselves. That's most probably the reason she said that. Return to your mothers means to return to live with your mothers in the separate apartments. Now, Naomi in verse 8 says, "May the Lord deal kindly with you, Ruth and Orpah, as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Now, how had Ruth and Orpah dealt kindly with Naomi? Well, first of all, they refused to marry other husbands after Naomi's sons, Mahlon and Chilion, had died. While their husbands were still living, they had given affectionate care to those husbands. And after they died, they took care of Naomi. Instead of remarrying, they took care of Naomi. They fed her. They supported her. So yes, they had been very kind to Naomi, these Moabite women. So Naomi tries to put a blessing on them. She says, "May the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." That means her new husband. What she's saying is, "I hope you go back to Moab and find a husband, a Moabite husband." We go now to Ruth chapter 1, verses 10 through 13. "No," they said to her, "we will go with you to your people, to the Jews. But Naomi replied, "Return home, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Am I able to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me to have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to grow up? Would you restrain yourselves from remarrying?" In other words, before her projected hypothetical sons grow up, could Naomi and Ruth and Orpah keep from finding another husband to marry? Naomi is saying a rhetorical question. Naomi is saying, of course you can't. You're going to get remarried. I'm not going to be able to find a husband. You're not going to be able to wait so long for more sons to grow up that you could marry them. "No, my daughters," Naomi continues, "my life is much too bitter for you to share because the Lord's hand is turned against me." Now notice in verse 10, both Ruth and Orpah are determined to go with Naomi back to Israel. "We will go with you to your people, to live with the Jews, to worship God with the Jews, perhaps, to look after Naomi." I'm not sure why they wanted to go back. We're not sure at what point Ruth became converted to the true religion of Yahweh, so we don't know what their motive was. But notice that Orpah and Ruth were both determined to go back at first. Naomi gives them the go back to Moab speech, and Orpah buys it and goes back. Ruth sticks with Naomi. Now when Naomi says to the girls, "Am I able to have any more sons who could become your husbands?" Some people say that she was thinking of the Levirate law. The Levirate law said that if a Jewish man died childless and he had brothers, that the deceased wife, the deceased widow, should marry the brother in order to raise up an inheritance to keep the deceased brother's family name alive. This is stated in Deuteronomy 25, verse 5, "When brothers live together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man." That's the widow. "Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her." Well, there's a problem with that. This Levirate law only has respect to a full brother, not a half brother. And what Naomi is contemplating here is getting married again, having another husband who would have sons through Naomi, and those new sons would be half brothers to Mahlah and Chilion, who were the deceased Elimelech's sons. And so the Levirate law would not really apply. Another option would be to say she was literally thinking that, hey, I can go back, get married again, have some more sons, let them grow up, and then they could marry Ruth and Orpah. Now, of course, Ruth and Orpah would be a little bit older than the sons, but I think that's preposterous to think she was actually thinking that. This was just, she was being histrionic. Hebrew hyperbole. Exaggeration. This is the way Jews talk. Even today, if you hear somebody imitating the Jewish idiom, say, for a Jew from New York, it's like this extreme exaggeration. And that's what Naomi's saying. She's saying, it ain't possible, folks. If you go back to Israel, it's not possible, my two daughters-in-law. If you go back to Israel, there's no hope for you there. Nobody for you to marry. Now remember, there are Moabite women going back to Israel. If they were looking for Israelite husbands were probably not going to marry two foreigners. And not only that, the last reason is, Naomi gives, "My life is much too bitter for you to share because the Lord's hand is turned against me." She thinks that God has turned against her, and so if God has turned against her, he's going to turn against her two daughters-in-law too. So maybe you better stay over here in Moab, where things are just a little brighter. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown give three reasons why Naomi was so insistent on asking her daughters-in-law to go back to Moab. First of all, she didn't want to get the daughters-in-law hopes up concerning their financial future in Israel, because Naomi thought the hand of the Lord was against her, so therefore she thought the hand of the Lord would be against Orpah and Ruth also. So there were financial reasons. Or maybe she realizes that Ruth and Orpah are making an emotional decision. They're crying. They're about to lose their beloved mother-in-law. And so Naomi is saying, look, Ruth and Orpah, don't make a decision now when your emotions are too high. Wait until your emotions are calmed down. Third reason why she's told them to go back to Moab could be that she is worried that their belief in Yahweh would be tested. Now, this is assuming that Ruth and Orpah have been converted to Yahweh through the hand of Naomi. And She is worried if they go back to Israel, they're going to be foreigners. They're going to have to renounce all their past life, all their Moabite customs. They might have to start quit eating shrimp and pork and who knows. And that might make them fall away from Yahweh. Well, I think that's kind of a stretch. I think the real reason is she just thought that there was no future for them in Israel. Nobody to marry. God's against Ruth. It's hopeless. Go back to Moab. You got a better shot. Now you will notice in verse 13 that Naomi was bitter against God. Nobody should ever be bitter against God. Now I'm telling you, when things are going bad, I can understand. It's very understandable that people get bitter against God. I mean, here, Naomi was widowed. She was bereft of her two sons. She had suffered through a 10-year famine. And I can understand she'd be like Job. Hey, God, what's going on here? What have I done to deserve this? The NIV Study Bible says this, quote, "It's true that God allowed tragedies to happen to Naomi, but he did not force her to respond with bitterness. She was responsible for that choice, not God." And that's a good application point to us. Don't ever get bitter with God. He loves you, and I know things can be tough, but Paul never got bitter with God. He ended up in jail, beaten with stripes. Pretty awful experience. Shipwreck. Oh, God, why are you doing this to me? He could have done that. He never did. But Naomi unfortunately did. So we go down to Ruth chapter 1, verse 14. "And they," that's Ruth and Orpah, "lifted up their voices and wept again." Maybe that includes Naomi too. All three of them lifted up their voices and wept again. "And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law." What that means is she kissed her goodbye. She went back to Moab. "But Ruth clung to her," because she's going back to Israel with Naomi. So Naomi convinced Orpah with her arguments, but not Ruth. Ruth was a little more stubborn. We go now to Ruth chapter 1, verses 15 through 18. Naomi said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her God. Follow your sister-in-law." But Ruth replied, "Do not persuade me to leave you or go back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May Yahweh punish me and do so severely if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go back with her, she stopped trying to persuade her. Now, Ruth was determined. It's a great speech, isn't it? In fact, this verse is quoted all the time. "Wherever you will go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Where you die, I will die. Your God will be my God." Yeah, she showed Naomi she wasn't just messing around. She really meant it. She was going to stick with Naomi through thick and thin, through hell and high water. She was going to stay with her. And Naomi saw that, so she stopped trying to persuade Ruth to go back. Now, many conclude that right here, that Orpah, who has gone back, Ruth's sister-in-law, Orpah, had gone back to Moab, that she had been a proselyte to Yahweh through the ministry of Naomi, and she had renounced her faith to go back. Well, I think that's assuming too much. You could live in Moab and still be a proselyte to Yahweh. Verse 15 also says, "Your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her God." Now, that sounds like she did renounce her faith. The Holman Christian Study Bible margin here says gods. John Gill said the gods were Baal, Peor, and Chemosh, two nasty pagan gods. So perhaps Orpah did renounce her faith. The next question is, well, let's stick with Orpah here for a minute before we go to Ruth. It has been speculated that Naomi really didn't want Orpah to go when she was telling Orpah to go back to Moab, but she was testing Orpah's faith. Go back to Moab. And then secretly she's thinking, I want to see if she'll go back to those gods or whether she'll stick with Yahweh. I don't think so. I think Naomi was more concerned about Orpah socially rather than religiously. One of my commentators, whose name unfortunately has been lost, says this, "Naomi knew Ruth and Orpah as foreigners would socially be at a great disadvantage in Israel. She urged them to go back because she cared about them. In the ancient Middle East, people were seen as an inseparable unit, part and parcel with their land and their gods." And so she's saying, go back to your land, go back to your people, go back to your God. So Naomi is worried about Orpah's social and financial fate, really. And that's why she told her to go back. I don't think she was testing her religious faith in Yahweh. Unfortunately, that's probably exactly what happened to Orpah. She probably went back to Moab and fell back into paganism again. Now, these famous words of Ruth, "Wherever you go, I will go," how many times have you heard that repeated at wedding ceremonies? In fact, I've heard it so much that when I sat down to study the book of Ruth and realized that Ruth was saying this not to Boaz, but to Naomi, I was sort of shocked. And again, that shows how traditions trump the scripture so many times in our minds. Ruth's words here were words of a religious commitment. "Your God will be my God," not a marital commitment to a husband. Now, Ruth is so worked up here at this time, she says, "I'd rather die. May God make me die. May he kill me if I don't stick with you until you die." Now, those are some strong words. It was an oath. "May Yahweh punish me and do so severely." That's an oath. Now, why would Ruth take an oath in the name of the Lord before she believed in the Lord? Well, here's some options to answer that question. First of all, maybe she actually already believed in the Lord. Maybe Naomi had converted her in the past. And I suspect that's what's happened. Many people say that she converted right here on the spot with all this religious fervor, or this emotional outburst here to Naomi, that this was her conversion. The NIV Study Bible says this, quote, "Ruth's words indicated the depth of her loyalty. She recognized that this was a life and death decision. Taking a vow of this sort was not uncommon in ancient times. It was an expression of intense feelings." Well, that doesn't really say that the conversion happened at the time of the oath. It just says that the oath shows the depth for passion. Adam Clark, however, says that he believed Ruth got converted here. He says, quote, "They were probably both idolaters," they being Orpah and Ruth. "They having been proselytes is an unfounded conjecture." Again, it's right. There's no basis for it. It's just a conjecture that they had been converted beforehand by Naomi. Clark continues, "Chemosh was the grand idol of the Moabites. The conversion of Ruth probably commenced at this time." Here's another quote from an unnamed commentator, because I lost the quote. "Ruth's decision to leave Moab and go with Naomi was literally a conversion. She vowed to serve Naomi's God. Later, Boaz recognized her as a believer." That's in the next chapter, verse 12, Ruth 2. Boaz says, "May the Lord reward your work, Ruth, and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." That sort of sounds like Ruth is converted. Boaz is talking to her like she's trying to shelter under the wings of the Almighty, Yahweh. Well, anyway, this is all speculation. We don't know when Ruth converted, but by golly, she shows faithfulness to her mother-in-law. Now, how much that faithfulness transfers over to faithfulness to Yahweh, again, is speculation, but I think it's reasonable to speculate that she believes in Yahweh. Well, I mean, she said, "May Yahweh punish me." That sounds like she's believing in Yahweh. It doesn't prove it, but we go down to Ruth chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. "So they both," that's Naomi and Ruth, "went until they came to Bethlehem." That, of course, is Naomi's old home place, her old stomping grounds. "And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' She said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me." Well, I said Naomi was bitter. Well, this makes it clear. She's bitter. She's tromping the dirt, coming back to Bethlehem on foot, no money for a camel, no money for an ass to carry them. They walk all the way from Moab into Bethlehem. Now, all the city was stirred. That's probably because Naomi and Elimelech were highly regarded in Bethlehem before they left. And remember, Bethlehem is not a huge place. Verse 19, "The women of the town said, 'Is this Naomi?'" Now, this is what the women of Bethlehem could have been thinking. They could have been surprised. "Is this Naomi? We thought she'd long been dead and gone. And she comes back? She's come back from the dead? Can this be Naomi?" Or it could be some of the women had scorn. "Is this Naomi? She's left her native land, gone to live with those pagan Moabites, and now she's coming back? Really? Or it could be, "Can this really be Naomi? This is too good to be true." Or maybe they didn't physically recognize Naomi. Maybe Naomi was more shriveled and wrinkled than before. Perhaps she was beautiful when she was younger in Bethlehem, and now she's not, having lived through the famine, and so people don't even actually recognize her. Well, for whatever reasons, the women were shocked, and Naomi responds, "Don't call me Naomi." Now, Naomi means pleasant. "Do not call me pleasant, call me Mara." Mara means bitter. Well, We said she was bitter, and she called herself bitter, so it's clear she was bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. You know, Jeremiah felt the same way. He had seen Israel burnt down to the ground, and Jeremiah says in Lamentations 3:15, he had seen Jerusalem burnt to the ground. Jeremiah says in Lamentations 3:15, he has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drunk with wormwood. Wormwood's a bitter spice. Now, with typical exaggeration, Naomi exaggerates things. She says, I went out full. Oh, really? She went out full to Moab? If I recall, it was a famine. That's not full. Adam Clark says that what she meant, though, was not that she went out with plenty of money or food. She went out with a husband and two sons. And Elimelech probably took all of his money with him. So she said, I had money, I had two sons, I had a husband. So she might not have been exaggerating. She might have literally just been referring to her family, not the money, not the famine part of her existence. The Lord has witnessed against me. That's Yahweh, Lord, capital L-O-R-D. Almighty is another name that she uses for God. That's Shaddai, God Almighty, El Shaddai. We go now to the last verse in chapter 1, and we'll finish this audio. Verse 22, so Naomi returned. That means she returned to Bethlehem, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest, of the beginning of barley harvest. That would be the first Feast of First Fruits, which was held on the 16th of Nisan, according to the law. Second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, if I recall. This is the 16th of Nisan. The sheaf of first fruits, sheaf of barley, was offered to the temple, the tabernacle then. And that was the beginning of spring, because Nisan, of course, is in spring, March/April. And so Ruth is now ready to begin her new life in Israel at the beginning of the spring, when she's going to meet the man of her dreams. Which makes this such a romantic story, and that's why girls love this book, the Book of Ruth. So we'll look at that in our next audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.